Good afternoon. Thank you so much. What a wonderful turnout for this panel. Really appreciate all of you being here today. We're going to speak from here. Hopefully this will be fine for everyone to be able to see. If not, let us know, see and hear. My name is Lori Bonai. I teach at Seattle University School of Law, where I'm the director of the Fred T. Korematsu Center for Law and Equality. As you know, in 1942, three men, Gordon Hirabayashi, Min Yasui, and Fred Korematsu, challenged the military orders that culminated in the World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans. Each was arrested for defying the orders. Each was convicted in federal court and challenged their convictions to the U.S. Supreme Court. In three of the most infamous cases in U.S. Supreme Court history, the court upheld their convictions, holding that the orders were justified by military necessity. Joining us here today are members of Gordon, Min, and Fred's families to share with us a more personal insight into these men who resisted the wartime incarceration and later fought for vindication. Our panelists' more complete biographies are in the program that you have in your packet, but I'd like to at least briefly introduce them now. Joining us are, to my left, Jay Hirabayashi, the son of Gordon Hirabayashi. Jay is presently executive director of Kokoro Dance and the Vancouver International Dance Festival in Vancouver, British Columbia. To my right is Holly Yasui, daughter of Min Yasui. Holly is presently working with CEDESA, the Center for Agricultural Development, a grassroots rural training center in Dolores, Hidalgo, Mexico. To my far right here is Karen Korematsu, daughter of Fred Korematsu. Karen is presently co-founder and executive director of the Korematsu Institute for Civil Rights and Education in San Francisco, California. I'd like to take a few minutes to provide some brief overview of the legal background to Fred, Gordon, and Min's cases before turning the program over to our wonderful panelists and having time at the end for questions and discussion. So just some brief background from the lawyer up here. On February 19, 1942, as you all know, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. That order was a blank check delegating to the Secretary of War or his designee the authority to issue any orders that they saw fit to ensure domestic security. While EO 9066 was race neutral on its face, there was no question but that it was issued so that the military could handle, quote, the Japanese problem on the West Coast. A month later, Congress made violation of any military order issued pursuant to Executive Order 9066 a federal crime. Pursuant to that grant of authority, Lieutenant General John L. DeWitt, commander of the Western Defense Command, began issuing a series of orders. First, he issued a curfew order requiring all enemy, quote, enemy aliens and any person of Japanese ancestry to stay in their homes during the evening hours. Soon thereafter, General DeWitt issued a freeze order prohibiting any person of Japanese ancestry from leaving the West Coast except pursuant to, as ordered by the military. And finally, of course, he began issuing a series of 108 civilian exclusion orders up and down the West Coast, in area by area. While DeWitt and the courts called these exclusion orders, I'm going to call them removal orders and incarceration orders, because that's really what they did. They really weren't just exclusion orders. They were orders, of course, requiring Japanese Americans to report for unlimited confinement. Min Yasui was a 25-year-old attorney when he decided to defy DeWitt's curfew order in Portland, Oregon. As you've heard a great deal about during this conference, Gordon Hirabayashi was a 24-year-old senior at the University of Washington when he decided to defy the curfew and refused to report for incarceration. Fred Korematsu was a 22-year-old welder living in Oakland, California, when he refused to report for removal and incarceration. These young men took extraordinary stands in defying the military orders. They were imprisoned, they risked their futures, and they were ostracized by many in their own community for taking the positions they took. Despite these obstacles, all three men fought their cases and appealed their convictions up to the U.S. Supreme Court. While there were some differences between the three cases, the end result was basically the same. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the military orders on the basis that they were justified by imminent military necessity. Gordon's case was the first one decided in June of 1943. Min's was a companion case decided the same day. The court in the Hirabayashi case and the companion case of Yasui limited its review to the issue of whether the curfew was constitutional. In limiting its review to only the question of the constitutionality of the curfew, the Supreme Court dodged the whole issue of the legality of the wholesale removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast, and it would dodge that question for a year and a half. The court upheld the constitutionality of the curfew order, expressing extreme deference to the military during times of war, and accepting the government's argument that aspects of Japanese culture made Japanese Americans more susceptible to influence from Japan, and accepted the government's argument that there was insufficient time for individual hearings to determine who was loyal and who was purportedly disloyal. For all of these reasons, the court upheld the constitutionality of the curfew order in the Hirabayashi case. A year and a half later, in December 1944, in Fred's case, the court was called upon to decide the constitutionality of the removal and exclusion orders. Although, of course, the removal and exclusion orders were far greater deprivations of liberty than the curfew order at issue in Gordon's case, the Supreme Court said that it would uphold the exclusion and removal orders for all the same reasons it upheld the curfew orders in the Hirabayashi case. The court concluded Fred Korematsu was not excluded from the military area because of any hostility to him or his race. Unbelievably, this is what the court said. Instead, the court explained that he was removed because there was a military urgency that demanded the removal of all citizens of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast. In the years following the cases, of course, the cases were widely condemned by legal scholars, but there was no avenue for attacking them. Until 1981, when Professor Peter Irons and archival researcher Aiko Herzig-Yoshinaga discovered surprising new evidence that proved that the government had suppressed, altered, and destroyed material evidence while it was arguing the Hirabayashi, Yasui, and Korematsu cases before the wartime Supreme Court. For example, General DeWitt had prepared a final report designed to be the Army's kind of official explanation of the reasons for the incarceration. When it was discovered that DeWitt's report contradicted the government's argument before the Supreme Court, his report was ordered revised. And the, quote, bad versions of the report were ordered burned and destroyed. And the altered version of the report was given to the U.S. Supreme Court. Further, the documents show that the government had within its possession its own intelligence reports from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Federal Communications Commission, the Office of Naval Intelligence, all concluding that Japanese Americans were loyal and advising against mass internment and soundly contradicting DeWitt's claims of illegal espionage and sabotage activities on the part of Japanese Americans. Two of the government's own lawyers advised their superiors that the government had to tell the U.S. Supreme Court about these reports, and they were overruled by their superiors. So the Supreme Court was never told about these reports. Based on this evidence, Gordon, Min, and Fred filed petitions for writ of error coram nobis, seeking to vacate their convictions based on allegations of governmental fraud. Fred's conviction was vacated by the Honorable Marilyn Hall Patel in San Francisco in November of 1983. I was honored to serve on that legal team together with Eric Yamamoto, who just delivered our wonderful lunchtime remarks seeking global, the call to action to seek global justice. Min's conviction was vacated by the Honorable Robert Baloney in Portland, Oregon in January 1984. Gordon Hirabayashi's conviction was ultimately vacated by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in September 1987 in an opinion written by Judge Mary Schroeder, who you heard from this morning. And also, I'll note my sister Catherine Bonai is in this room, who was his initial head legal counsel here. With the vacation of their convictions, Fred, Gordon, and Min's names were cleared. But even more importantly, their cases established that the Supreme Court opinions were the product of a fraudulent record. Their cases show that the government at times may go to extraordinary, even illegal lengths in order to justify its actions. And their cases serve to underscore that the public and the courts must remain vigilant to protect civil liberties, especially during times of perceived national crisis. In the years following the Coram Nobis cases, all three men continued to speak out about the wrong done to Japanese Americans and to speak about their cases. Sadly, all three men have now passed. Their children have now taken on the task of advancing their father's legacies by continuing to use the examples of their stories to protect the civil rights of others. Most recently, in December of 2012, Karen, Jay, Holly, and their siblings submitted an amicus brief in the case of Hedges versus Obama. That case, now before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, challenges the provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act, a federal statute that, like EO 9066, gives the military a blank check, permitting it to detain individuals without due process, notice, or a hearing, even American citizens on U.S. soil, if suspected of supporting terrorist activity. In their amicus brief, the Korematsu, Hirabayashi, and Yasui children remind the country of their father's cases and ask the court to ensure that this country not again unjustifiably sacrifice civil liberties in the name of national security. We know Gordon, Min, and Fred today for their historic stances, the historic stances they took during World War II. I'm now pleased to be able to introduce their children, who can better share with you who they were as individuals. So I'm going to start out with Jay Hirabayashi.
I have to say it, first of all, that I've struggled a bit with being on public forums like this to honor our fathers, because my relationship with my father was one of father and son and not one of national hero and son. and the two relationships are quite different. My father never supposed that he was a hero and never spoke of himself as being a hero. He told my sisters and I when we were quite small that he had been in prison, but it was just one of those facts when you're a kid that you just go, okay, you know, and you don't really understand all the reasons for that little bit of history that you were told. I was born here in Seattle. My father, after getting out of prison, went back to University of Washington and got his PhD in sociology. And the first position that he chose to take was as a professor at the American University in Beirut, Lebanon. So our family left Seattle when I was almost five. And we lived in Beirut for a few years, and then he took a job at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. So I think grade six, uh, grade part of grade 3, grade 4, and grade 7, I was in Cairo, Egypt. And then the third job that he took was at the University of Alberta in Canada, in Edmonton, Alberta. So I went to junior high and high school there. So altogether, I think I went to 8 different schools in 12 years and got really confused about who I was or where I was from. I think my father chose to take all those jobs outside of the U.S. partly because he's interested as a sociologist in other cultures, but I think also partly because he was disenchanted with the lack of support that he had in the United States. And I think he perhaps might have thought that raising his kids outside the U.S. might have been better for us. I'm not sure exactly. I didn't know much about my father's early history until I was 19, and I was working in a summer resort in Colorado, and a fellow worker who was a law student from Denton, Texas, asked me if I was related to Gordon Hirabayashi, and I was surprised that somebody from Texas would know my father. But he said that at his law school, my father's Supreme Court case was studied as one of the few examples where the Supreme Court made a mistake. And it was at that time that I began to realize what those stories about prison meant. when I was... when I got out of high school, I went to Europe and traveled or hitchhiked around, and I turned 18 over there, so I registered for the draft in Lyon, France, and I applied for conscientious objector status because I'd been raised as a pacifist Quaker. Then my father... spent a considerable amount of money fixing up my Uncle Dick's basement for me to live in here in Seattle, and I was supposed to go to University of Washington for 4 years. So he thought it was a good investment. But I flunked out after 1 year and and decided to go to back to Europe and become a poet. And I only made it as far as Colorado. In the meantime, this is kind of a long story, but I had been turned down from my conscientious objector's status and had appealed that decision. And so the FBI investigated me and in Seattle and in Colorado and came up with a interesting 6-page document that mostly reported about how intoxicated I was in that summer of 1966, but also that people knew me as a Quaker. And they appointed a lawyer from to represent the Justice Department who interviewed me and wrote a recommendation that I should get that conscientious objector status, so I ended up getting it. My father at that time was not speaking to me because I had quit school, and he was out of a lot of money for fixing up my uncle's basement. So... what happened then was I got a notice that I had to find a job in the national interest. I was given 90 days as a CO. I was drafted, basically. At the time, I was trying to be a downhill ski racer and was having some success, and I had dreams of getting on the U.S. Olympic team and kind of resented being drafted. So I decided that I would go back to Canada and try and get on the Canadian Olympic team. So I drove back to Canada, but found out in Canada that it wasn't the same as it was harder actually in Canada to be a ski bum than in Aspen. So it made me start to think about the draft, and I talked to my father. By then, he had reconciled and was speaking to me again. I talked to him about the my situation and told him that I had decided to send my draft cards back and go back to the States and face the music of whatever that that meant. So I wrote this letter in 1969 to my draft board. I said, "Sirs, I can no longer cooperate in any way with the Selective Service system with a free conscience. I am disturbed to such an extent by the unfairness of the system, by the very purpose of the system, that I am returning my draft cards and declaring my intention of not doing alternative service or any other service or form of cooperation with the Selective Service system. I call on you members of my former local board to join with me in protest of this hideous affront to human dignity. I ask you to resign from your positions with this ill-conceived organization. Please consider that war has never brought everlasting peace. Is it not time to try something else?" And I signed it, "Love and Peace, J. Hirayoshi. My father, in 1944, as chronicled in this wonderful book that my cousin Lane and my late uncle Jim edited from my dad's papers, he also refused to fill out a special draft questionnaire that was given only to Americans of Japanese ancestry. And from this book, he says, "I had to go to great lengths arguing with my local draft board that my position was a positive one, that of desiring to be a conscientious citizen. It was this desire that for me prevented participation in the military as a way of achieving peace and democracy and other ideals for which we stood. I sent a letter to the draft board. Did you check the files to see if my records are in there? If they are, do you want me to fill this in again, or is that good enough? Secondly, did you send this loyalty questionnaire as standard stuff to all persons or only to persons of Japanese ancestry? And I never heard anything for 3 weeks, so I sent back a cover letter without filling in the questionnaire. I presume you only send these to Japanese. I can't participate in a policy based on racial discrimination." After about 6 weeks, the FBI came and said, "We're supposed to pick you up." So I was checked into jail. When my father, what my father did in 1944 definitely affected and influenced my own actions, but he never pushed me to make the decision that I made in 1969. He supported that decision, but there was no pressure from him. He wanted me to find my own way of coming to terms with how to relate to society. And I think my decision was much easier than his because the Vietnam War was not a popular one, and there were about 50,000 draft resistors at the same time as me. So when I reflect on his stand during World War II, when he was really without any support from his country or from his own Japanese-American community, I am awed by his courage and his self-assurance that his choices were the only ones that any logical person could make. My father is a hero to me now, but growing up, he was just my dad, a patient, open-minded, caring man who taught me through the way he lived. And I learned more about his life as a young man from others and from books than I did from him. And that's all I wanted to share with you today. Thank you.
My dad was always, or almost always, my hero, but that was not true for everyone, nor at all times. When he initiated his case in 1942, he was not considered a hero. The press labeled him a treacherous Jap spy, and the National Secretary of the Japanese American Citizens League, JCL, called him, and I quote, a self-serving martyr seeking headlines. In 1944, when he visited the Heart Mountain draft resistors to persuade them to withdraw their cases, they felt betrayed by Minyasui, the public figure who defied the military curfew, but then 2 years later opposed their stand on principle, their way of challenging the relocation camps. Heroism is relative. What some consider heroic may be reviled or rejected by others, and attitudes may change over time, hopefully towards recognition and reconciliation rather than resignation and bitterness. So what was Minoru Yasui like, not as a hero, but as a person, as a father? Well, he was a wonderful dad. He was loving, attentive, and generous. I've read stories by children of activists who felt neglected and overshadowed by the importance of their parents' cause, but I never felt that way. He and my mom made special efforts to include my sisters and me in their activities, which included their work. In the early days, when my mom was my dad's secretary, she took us downtown with her after school and on weekends. My dad was a self-employed attorney, so there was no problem for us to hang out in his office, which is a proverbial hole in the wall, a crumbling and derelict wall at that, in the heart of Denver's Skid Row. His clients were mostly Japanese Americans, impoverished by their wartime experiences, and other low-income minorities. We were all, frankly, quite poor. For that reason, my dad often received merchandise instead of cash for his legal services. We kids loved going to the Japanese store around the corner because they gave us comic books and trinkets on credit. And we ate next door at the Akabona restaurant for free. One year, a Nisei farmer gave us a live turkey that we kept in our backyard. It was a really big, mean bird. It had beady eyes and a sharp beak, and we were all afraid of it. Though it wasn't exactly a pet, when November rolled around, we just couldn't kill it for Thanksgiving. So we gave it back to the original owner, since unlike city people, farmers aren't queasy about slaughtering livestock. What a deal. Not only did my dad not get paid, we also fattened up that mean old turkey for months, and somebody else ate it. We kids liked helping with the AJA news. AJA stood for Americans of Japanese Ancestry. My dad wrote and edited it, and my mom typed it up. She was an incredible typist, 120 words per minute. My sisters and I ran the mimeograph and the addressograph machines. This was before photocopiers and long before computers. And we folded and sorted the newsletters by postal code for bulk mailing in our front room. My dad was also a Boy Scout leader. I think that was his antidote to his all-female family, wife and three girls, and an essentially sedentary job. He loved the outdoors, a love from his own childhood growing up near the Great Columbia River in Oregon. In the 1950s and 60s, he took his ragtag multiracial Boy Scout Troop 38 camping in the mountains west of Denver once a month all year round. My sisters and I got to tag along in the summer, and during those long sunny days, he sometimes took us on fishing trips. I could never push a live worm through a hook, but I liked sitting with my dad at the side of a stream, not talking. He said that scared the fish away. Just enjoying the natural tranquility of the beautiful Rocky Mountains. Summer was also our family trip time. We all piled into our station wagon in June, and we drove to the West Coast, to the Midwest, to the East Coast. In between sightseeing stops, my dad attended meetings and gave speeches in community centers, churches, barns, wherever people would gather and listen. He was an old-style orator who mesmerized crowds with his vivid stories and his grandiose delivery. That's how I heard many of the anecdotes that had become part of our family lore. I later realized that what my dad was doing is what we now call networking. He was weaving and maintaining a social fabric among Japanese Americans who had been, who after the war had been dispersed all across the American landscape. So in our home, the subject of the relocation camp was not taboo, not cloaked in silence or shame. When I was a child, in fact, I thought the camp where my mom was interned, Granada, was like the summer camp that I attended, because she often talked about her friends from camp in wistful tones that made me think that it had been a lot more fun than raising a family on a shoestring. My dad, on the other hand, really liked to tell the story about how he initiated his test case, walking down the streets of Portland for hours after the 8 p.m. curfew proclaimed by General DeWitt, trying to get arrested, but to no avail. Finally, he marched into the police headquarters and insisted that it was the duty of the police to arrest him. We always laughed at the punchline. The officer told him to run along home, son, or you're going to get into trouble. That anecdote has made its way into most of the accounts about my dad's arrest, and I always enjoy reading it because I remember very clearly his intonation, his expression when he told it. He was aware of his tendency to be somewhat bombastic at times, and he wasn't above poking a little bit of fun at himself. I also think it was important to him to remind people that not all the authorities were prejudiced. Some were even somewhat sympathetic. Another family story about my grandma, Shizu Yasui, always impressed me deeply. In 1942, she was heading the household in Hood River alone, since my grandfather had been taken away by the first FBI sweep after Pearl Harbor. My dad had gotten himself arrested on a Friday night, and over the weekend, his photo was splashed on the front page of the newspaper with the blazing headline, "Jap Spy Arrested." So on Monday, he phoned his mother from the Multnomah County Jail, and he apologized for causing her so much worry. She replied, "Shinpai dokoro ka." My Japanese is not so good. "Shinpai dokoro ka. Susumeru yo, gambatte." "I'm not worried. I support you. Persevere." This from a woman dealing with the disappearance of her husband, and in his absence and without a word of English, she was managing the family farm and store in the midst of great uncertainty and hostility. She didn't complain or scold her son. Instead, she encouraged him. I think that tells volumes about where Minyasui got his courage and the will to see his case through to the bitter end. Perhaps my dad was not as good a provider as some. I know that my mom struggled mightily to pay bills, feed, and clothe us. But making money was never a high value in our household, though I imagine my mom sometimes wished it had a little higher priority. In the mid-1960s, my dad gave up his very unlucrative private practice of law, and he took a job with the City and County of Denver as director of the Commission on Community Relations. I later figured out that when my oldest sister entered high school, he and my mom decided he had to make more money, or at least have a regular income so that they could send her to college, and my other sisters and me, in subsequent years. Education, as opposed to money, was a big deal. So, of course, I did go to college, and it was there that I learned more about the larger context of my dad's wartime experience, and I started writing a play about his test case that I didn't finish until after his death. I learned that in 1941, he was working for the Japanese consulate in Chicago. It wasn't an onerous job. It was an honorable job, but not an onerous job. And he made a good salary, much better than he could make as a lawyer. Though he had graduated from law school at the University of Oregon and passed the state bar, it wasn't easy for a Nisei to get a job in a law firm in those days. They wanted white boys. They didn't want minorities, nor for that fact matter, women. So on Pearl Harbor Day, he received a wire from his father, Masuo Yasui, admonishing him, "Your country needs your service as a U.S. Reserve officer." My dad had been commissioned as a second lieutenant in College ROTC. He immediately resigned his job and set off for Oregon. When he reported for duty in Fort Vancouver, the Army turned him away several times. He was stubbornly insistent, determined to heed his father's directive and to prove his loyalty. The Army didn't know what to do with him. Finally, they reclassified him 4C, not acceptable for military service. That must have been a blow to him because he always talked about the 442nd with great admiration. To him, those young Nisei soldiers, many of whom gave their lives, were indisputable heroes, and their heroism, more than anything else, helped to dispel the suspicion of disloyalty that plagued Japanese Americans during and even after the war. In January of 1942, my dad set up an impromptu law office in Portland to help the Japanese Americans with filing of birth certificates, property titles, tax documents, etc. When Roosevelt declared Executive Order 9066, my dad consulted with local attorneys and federal authorities about the constitutionality of military orders based on that proclamation. As a lawyer, he knew the only way to stop the exclusion, or as Laurie has said, the actual evacuation, relocation of Japanese Americans from the newly created Western Defense Command, was to bring a test case to court and to get a legal stay. He searched for a suitable volunteer, a veteran, or a man with a beautiful wife and cute kids, but no one of such sterling or sympathetic character was willing to put his family and his future at stake. As the situation worsened, he realized it was up to him not only to defend the Kiss case, but also to be the one to violate the first sanctionable regulation against Japanese Americans. That turned out to be the curfew. And the rest, as they say, is history. In the 1970s and 80s, my dad was working on redress and his Coram Nobis case. I was a college student, into redefining my identities and bucking the system, which sometimes put me at odds with him. For example, he was not sympathetic, as I was, to the anti-war movement and radical protest tactics. I learned about the Heart Mountain draft resistors after his death, so I was never able to ask him about that painful story. Several years ago at a conference, I found myself in an awkward position of trying to represent his stance, with which I did not entirely agree. In my play, I created a character, a boyhood friend who became a no-no boy and a draft resistor, in order to try to address the emotional and moral complexities that the young Nisei faced during that incredibly difficult time. I've only recently read the Lim report, and last night I saw Farewell to Manzanar, which shows an entirely different view of the JCL than the image I grew up with. Throughout his life, my dad was an active and vociferous member of the JCL, in spite of the stunning disavowal issued by that organization in 1943. After my dad retired from his job, city in Denver, he went into action, full blast, as national director of the JCL Redress Committee. He wrote letters to the president and his cabinet, members of Congress, friends and colleagues of influential politicians of all stripes. He made thousands of phone calls, hundreds of speeches. He gave interviews. He attended meetings every day, sometimes several per day. He was a virtual lobbying machine set on high drive because he knew his time was limited, and that of the Issei even more so. I'm sorry my dad didn't live to see the signing of the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, but I believe that for him, the results were never as important as the process, the work of carrying on the vision, as the Coram Nobis attorneys have done with various amicus briefs over the years. And as Eric mentioned today at the luncheon speech, there's so much work still to be done. My dad experienced so many so-called failures that might have discouraged a person with less faith in justice. The dismissal in 1943 of his original case, his unsuccessful bid for national JCL president in the 80s on a platform based on focusing all the organization's efforts into redress, then satisfactory resolution of his Coram Nobis case without an evidentiary hearing. But he never wavered. He did persevere, as his mother and father taught him. I'd like to end my presentation with an affirmation of what my dad said to me when I was a child, a teenager, and an adult, and what he told me that his father told him, that we are born into this world for purpose, and that purpose is to make it a better place. This is not only an altruistic motto, but in its generality, deeply generous. My dad was not insistent nor demanding about what his daughters or anyone else did to fulfill their purposes. None of his three girls became lawyers and much less public figures. He never imposed his opinions on us. Even when I was a know-it-all college student, he respected my right to think differently. But my sisters and cousins and I and many other young people, that is young when he was not, have in fact followed not so much in his exact footsteps, but the path that he forged, each doing our best to make the world a better place, each in our own way, two of our own convictions and passions and our own life experiences. Thank you.
Karen Coram, Matsu, Fred's daughter.
Good afternoon. This is really quite a turnout, and unfortunately, I only have a few minutes to talk about my father, which I could be here for the rest of the afternoon, it seems like. With these other inspiring stories, it makes you remember a lot more and at that time. No one ever says to a child when they're born, someday you're going to grow up to be an American civil rights hero. It's the life experiences along the way that help you to determine your life's work and to help you make those tough decisions at the time when you're faced with determining whether it's right or wrong. And for my father, he lived by his principles. Not everyone can say that. He had a great sense of right and wrong. He was born in Oakland, California. He was the third son of four boys. So to him, he was always odd man out. And his older brothers would always tell him what to do. My grandfather had a flower nursery. Fortunately, he was able to buy land before the alien land law took into effect on August 10th, 1913. And so he was able to build a flower nursery and a house in the industrial area of Oakland that was nearest to San Leandro, which was another little small town. And so my father got the jobs of hoeing and weeding and painting and you know, because the older brothers always told him what to do. And, you know, the youngest one, his youngest brother, Joe, was the baby. And, of course, he got doted on the most. So it was kind of those experiences, I think. He was always very, very independent. And he had a lot of Caucasian friends. And he liked everything as an American kid would, hot dogs, hamburgers, hanging out with his buddies. And that's the way he grew up. But he did experience racism especially in high school. And so he got to that age when he wanted to get a haircut by a real barber. You know, his mother had always cut his hair. And he went over to the small town of San Leandro a few blocks away and walked into a barber shop. And the white barber man said to him, "Hey, boy, what do you want?" And my father said, "Well, I want to get a haircut." And the barber said, "Hey, Jap, you get out of here. You don't belong here. You go down to Chinatown." And so those are the kinds of experiences that he started to face. And then he went into San Leandro and went into a coffee shop. And so the cook behind the counter said, "Hey, what do you want?" My father said, "Well, I want to get something to eat. And he said, "No, you don't belong here. You go down to Chinatown." So those were, you know, those types of experiences you internalize. He was very, very hurt. And so, before the war, before Pearl Harbor, there was talk of the draft. You know, America knew they were going to be getting into the war. And so he and his buddies were sitting around one Friday night, you know, playing cards, and they said, "Well, there's going to be this draft. If we enlist together, then we can stay together." So they decided to go down to the local post office. And that back in those days, that's how you signed up for the military. And they had long tables like this. And at first, they went to the National Guard table, and he had three Caucasian buddies with him. And the officer gave his Caucasian buddies the applications, and he wouldn't give one to my father. And my father said, "Well, I want an application." And the officer said, "Well, no, we have orders that we can't give anyone that's Japanese a application," because he had asked my father his name. And so his three buddies said, "Well, come on, Fred, let's go down to the Coast Guard desk." And so they tried again, and my father was refused to be given an application. And my father said, "But I'm an American. I want to serve my country." So he was really hurt and really upset. That was very embarrassing for him, because that's the way he thought of himself. He was an American. He just happened to be of Japanese ancestry. And so then with with the executive order being issued, of course, you know, my grandparents were just so focused on what was going to happen to their business, right? They had worked all those years raising their children, raising their sons, building up this flower nursery. What was going to happen? And they, for, you know, as many of you know, you have to figure out what you can take with you, what you have to leave behind. It was a very stressful time. And, you know, my father had an Italian-American girlfriend, not my mother. And so, you know, he felt like he was an American. He learned about the Constitution in high school. He thought he had civil rights. And he didn't think that what the government was doing, you know, was right at all, because no one, as you know, there was no hearings, there was no day in court. All the civil rights and civil liberties had been violated. And, you know, there's 120,000 that were incarcerated, and there's 120,000 different stories of Japanese and Japanese Americans. And everyone demonstrated their loyalty to this country. You know, I always thought even my father was like the only person that had been vilified from his own community. You know, until I went to Tule Lake Pilgrimage did I learn about the no-no boys and the draft resistors and the renunciators. You know, everyone demonstrated what it is to be loyal to this country. You know, we've talked about that during the conference. And that's the way my father felt. You know, he had this girlfriend who I think he was more in love with her, actually, than she was with him. He wanted to go to Nevada. There was that short window when you could kind of, you know, leave the area. And, you know, she was kind of dragging her heels, and she suggested he get, you know, plastic surgery. And so it was kind of minor plastic surgery, actually, because at the end of the day, my grandmother recognized my father. So it couldn't have been that much, you know. And he just, you know, he had been a welder. He went into being a welder. And so, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, then they terminated his job. You know, they used to work in the shipyards. And so, of course, you know, they didn't want anybody who was of Japanese ancestry working around anything that was military. And so he tried to get other odd jobs and changed his name to, it's Clyde Sarah. How he ever came up with that, I have no idea. Filipino or Hawaiian or something. It's a name that was, I think, made up. But, you know, he really felt that he just wanted to get on with his life. And so he didn't report. You know, he said something to my grandparents, and they said, well, Fred, you're old enough to decide what to do. And so he didn't report, because he just felt like it was wrong. He was American. He did nothing wrong. And so he was eventually, he was arrested on May 30th and on the corner in San Leandro, and, you know, had his first hearing in San Francisco. And Mr. Ernest Besick is, the attorney from the Northern California affiliate of the ACLU that visited my father and said to him, you know, would he be a test case? And my father said yes, and Mr. Besick said, well, we'll take it all the way to the Supreme Court if need be. And by the time, you know, my father said yes, and he couldn't believe the stranger would help him. He was a very quiet, you know, man. He wasn't one of these, you know, rebel rousers, and he was a very sensitive person. But he felt like by the time his case got to the Supreme Court, certainly they would see that this was unconstitutional. And he was so, you know, disgusted that they found, even though it was a 6-3 decision, that they still found him guilty. But he never gave up hope. I didn't know this until these attorneys came to my parents' house. We met the legal team in 1982. And until that time, I didn't know my father had always been looking for somebody to help him reopen his case. But, you know, he never said anything to me. He discussed it with my mother. But he never gave up hope. He really believed that someday it would be proved that, you know, the government was wrong and he was right. But he also carried that weight around, you know, because when he lost his case, he felt like he let down his whole Japanese American community. And that's a lot of burden to carry with you. And so the funny thing is when, like, Lori and some of the other young attorneys came to my parents' house, and he says to Professor Peter Irons, you know, these kids look like high school kids. Do you think they know what they're doing? And Peter Irons says, yes, you know, Fred, they're really the best. The best attorneys. And so, and unfortunately, they've all become our extended family, which is really, really unusual. And so, but I found out about my father's case in high school when my friend Maya gave a book report and talked about a famous Supreme Court case called Korematsu versus the United States. And I'm saying, oh, that's my name. And I've got 35 pairs of eyes turning and looking at me, and I'm, because she never said Fred. And so I, you know, have to wait till my father gets home, and I asked him, and I could just see the hurt and pain in his eyes when I asked him, you know, about this. And he said it happened a long time ago, and what he did, he thought was right, and the government was wrong. And it was that simple to him. But he loved this country, and he, you know, he's a great father, and of course, you know, but I think he thought that my brother and I might be ashamed of him if he talked about this. And then even when we found out, it's like, well, what does it mean to have a criminal record? I mean, you know, we don't know. But he just, you know, the fact that he, you know, he met my mother in Detroit, Michigan. He didn't even want to come back to California. He didn't think he'd ever come back because of what had happened. But my grandmother was ill, and so they came back to visit. But they weren't going to stay, but then they ended up staying. And so my brother and I were born in Oakland as well. But he, you know, he was the type of person that would give you the shirt off his back if you needed it, because he was that kind and honest. And he was part of the community. You know, he was involved in Boy Scouts and Lions Club. And so when his case was reopened, my husband likes me to talk about this because Judge Marilyn Hall Patel, who heard my father's case, it'll be 30 years actually this November. And my father was there in court and was able to say a few words. And he said to Judge Patel and the court, horse stalls are for horses, not for people. He had come into that courtroom in handcuffs, you know, several years earlier, and he had hoped that the court would see that the Japanese American incarceration was unconstitutional. And so that's when her, you know, she overturned his conviction. And he, I describe him as being all that time living in this cocoon. And after that time, he turned into a butterfly. Yeah, he did. He turned into a butterfly. And he was able to, you know, he felt like it was important to talk about this and to educate. And that's why he crisscrossed the United States, helped with redress. And when he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, he did so on behalf of everyone who had been incarcerated. And one quick story, because I have like 1 minute. They got a call. My father received the Presidential Medal of Freedom on January 15th, 1998. So in December, a month before, the phone rings, 9 o'clock in the morning. My father is not in, you know, he just kind of woke up. He's you know, elderly then. And at the other end, this voice says, Mr. Korematsu, yes. Well, Mr. Korematsu, this is the White House. Okay. Well, Mr. Korematsu, how are you? Okay. I mean, they just woke him up. Well, Mr. Korematsu, President Clinton would like to give you the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Okay. Well, Mr. Korematsu, can you come to the White House next month on January 15th to receive this honor? I don't know. You'll have to speak to my wife. And hands the phone to my mother. True story. Now, my mother is a very suspicious person. And so she grills this guy for an hour. Then finally kind of believes him. And he says, well, he's going to call back. So he calls back and he says to my mother, well, have you made your plane reservations and your hotel reservations? And she says, well, aren't you going to be sending an airline ticket? Aren't you going to be making the hotel reservations and, paying for them? No, you have to pay for your own expenses. So my father was retired. He never had a pension. He never could work for the government. He, was never in a union, so he didn't really have much money. And so my father, being kind of the humble, sensible person that he was, told my mother, well, just tell President Clinton then to send the medal to me in the mail because I can't afford to go. But we found the money for him to go. So that was the kind of person that he was. And so now, if he were here, he would remind all of you and future generations, which I am glad to see are attending this, that when you see something wrong, don't be afraid to speak up. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jay, Holly, Karen. What a tremendous privilege. I know I speak for everybody here, for you to have shared these stories with us. Of your fathers, of your love of your fathers, of your respect for your fathers. It's so interesting as a lawyer. My image, of course, of Fred Gordon and Min is larger than life. Actually, I think that they are people who've become events and symbols and verbs. Like, we don't want another Korematsu. We don't want another Hirabayashi. And this is so wonderful to see that these are men, these are individuals who were fathers, who were uncles, who were husbands, who were brothers, and it's a really wonderful reminder to all of us that these unjust laws affect people and their families and have enduring legacies across the generations. So I want to thank you so much for sharing with us. So please, we have about 15 minutes. We can open this up for all the questions you might have or comments or what you'd like to ask our wonderful panelists here.
Nowadays, you have plaintiffs and petitioners who have kind of followed in your father's footsteps and had followed this well-worn path on how to publicize their cases before the Supreme Court and that sort of thing. And most recently, Edith Windsor with the DOMA case. And I was wondering, your parents had seemingly no role models for this kind of petition. And I was wondering if you could speak to what their thoughts were, if they talked to you about it, actually deciding that they wanted to be the test cases and as they appealed upward.
I think in my father's case, he was going to University of Washington at the time, and when the curfew orders came out, his friends would all tell him that he had to go back to his dorm, and he would do that. But one day he just stopped and wondered why they didn't have to go, and he had to go, and that's when he decided that there was something wrong. And like Min, he had to go and say, look, it's after 8 o'clock and arrest me.
If I can remember the question, my dad, of course, had legal training. He was an attorney at the time that he was arrested, so he was quite aware of the legal aspects. I think he was 25 years old. I think he didn't really realize he didn't realize what it was going to be like to be in solitary confinement for 9 months, that's for sure. When he left the Multnomah County Jail, he went to Minidoka. And from there, he was still active in the JCL, as I say, in spite of this incredible disavowal that was admitted while he was in jail. To me, this is an amazing thing that for my father, the act was not only a legal act, and some authors have called my father legalist, which he was. But I think for him, it was also a very, very important social act, in that he continued to work with JCL, and he continued to try to get this injustice corrected through all his life, even after he lost his case. So I think in the case of my dad, it was a little bit different and unusual in that he did go in with full intention of testing the trial case, and there was no question in his mind whatsoever when the quorum nobis, the young attorneys, and I think he had the same response because they were all in their 20s, the same age that he was, the same age that our fathers were. But so, you know, you got to trust people in their 20s because they did okay. They did much more than okay, really. But no, there was no question in my dad's mind when the quorum nobis attorneys approached him. And I think that also was extremely important, not only for the legal aspect, but the fact that the Sansei generation was carrying on. That was very, very important to him.
The first time in 1942, after my father had been arrested and then ended up going to Tan Phrayan, the Assembly Detention Center, his oldest brother and wanted to get some of the other young men together to decide whether or not my father should fight his case at all. And so they met without him. I mean, they just even, you know, talked to him, asked his opinion or anything. They just, you know, decided on their own that my father should not fight his case, you know, because certainly they thought that even if they associated with my father, some harm might come to them. But my father, as his longtime childhood friend, Walt Herman, said, that Fred Korematsu is stubborn. And I think that carried him a long ways. I mean, but he wasn't going to be told no, because he felt deep down inside he was right. And he didn't really have, like, any kind of hero that he modeled himself after. It's just what he really believed in. And then same again, you know, when the evidence was found and Peter Irons, asked my father if he wanted to reopen his case. I mean, still, you know, the community at large, who was going through redress at the time, thought if my father's case, if he opened his case and lost, then they might lose their chances. And so he never really felt like he had support from his own community. But that wasn't going to deter him. He really wanted to do this because he just believed so deeply. But it was a risk. I mean, it was a risk that he could lose all over again. It was a risk for the quorum nobis attorneys, because if they lost these Supreme Court cases, you know, that's not a very good thing for your career if you're an attorney, you know. And so people did, you know, take risks. Even Judge Patel, you know, I feel like she, in my father's case, took a risk for making this decision that she made, because, you know, she wasn't going to let the government kind of do what they wanted to do. And they were trying to stall. They never wanted to, that was the thing. They were always trying to stall. So I think that's, you know, there's something in these men this running thread that just made them, you know, say, no, this is, we're going to fight this.
I'm curious, for a momentous decision like this at a time when the whole Japanese American community was under siege, it was an even greater decision for them to make. And Holly has mentioned that her dad was an attorney and he was used to dealing with right and wrong. But with Jay's dad and your dad, they were very young. And I'm curious whether in their lives there were incidents and decisions that they had made about their beliefs about right and wrong that were then a foundation for these decisions, or whether these decisions just really came out of the blue, out of the circumstances that they found themselves in.
I think partly is that my father was the eldest son. He had an older brother that died from an accident when he was quite young. Is his son? So I think he felt responsibility to, well, it was a dilemma for him as the eldest son to take the action that he did take, but partly he had been raised to make those kinds of decisions, I think, to take responsibility and to be responsible. I think that his upbringing, his parents were quite religious and had very strong views on what was right and wrong. I think those were factors, but I don't know if there was any specific incidents that that conditioned him to make the choices that he made. He was searching at that time for finding a place of worship that he and his friends were comfortable with, and had gone to a Quaker meeting and met my grandfather, Floyd Chmo, who was a very charismatic person. And I think he was impressed by my grandfather and inspired by him. And that may also have had some degree of influence in the choices that he made.
Yes, my father had legal training, but he was 25 years old. He had not really practiced law. He'd gone to law school. And I think it was just a question. I think it is the Issei who raised their children with this very strong sense of right and wrong. And the story about my grandmother has always amazed me, that she did support him. That was, to me, it was like a demonstration of the way she had raised him. When he called after he was arrested and apologized for causing her to worry, she didn't. She said, go for it. She said, I support you. And to me, that was basically a moment that demonstrated the strength of the Issei, who told their children taught their children to act upon what they believed was right and against what was wrong.
My father was a person that had learned, you know, about the Constitution in high school, as I said. So that left a big impression on him. He just wanted to be an American and do have all those rights as an American. And he just, like I said, lived by his principles. And it wasn't anything in particular, any other kind of other influence from another person that helped him make this decision. It was because he felt that what was happening was wrong. And it was that simple to him.
One of the prices that's not mentioned in this struggle was how the Japanese community often criticized those who took a stand. And I read about Fred Korematsu being blackballed in camp and elsewhere. I was wondering if Gordon and Min had this same kind of treatment from the Japanese community?
He definitely didn't have any support. I don't think his family were discriminated against because of his stand. I'm not sure about that, but it wasn't just the Japanese American community. It was the American Civil Liberties Union, and there was nobody actually except for a small circle of friends and the American Friends Service Committee that did support him. So that's one of the things that astonishes me, actually, when I think about it, about how isolated he was, and that he could, that he did what he did in purely on his own conviction that he was doing the right thing.
There was definitely not only a lack of support, but a very specific indictment against my father while he was in prison, or he was in jail. The JCL officially disavowed, said that he did not support any test cases. And as I say, this is a quote from a published bulletin of the JCL that Minyasui is a self-styled martyr seeking headlines. So this idea of there not being support is definitely the case with my father. One of the things that's so extraordinary to me is that my father forgave, and he continued, because for him, righting that wrong was more important than any personal hurt that he received. And I think he also knew the community had to be united, and the only way to unite your community is to forgive. And I think there was a lot of there was conflict. I mean, what a terrible time that was. I saw the film for the first time yesterday of Manzanar, and it's so extraordinary. I think one of the lessons that Eric was talking today at lunchtime, the amazing thing that this community has been able to come together and air out not only the terrible injustice that was done to our community, but within our community. And I think that's really, really important. We're losing a lot of the older people who experienced that. But I think this kind of conference is very important to remember also that there were many kinds of opposition, and that all the types of opposition that occurred during the World War II were very important to get us to where we are now.
Yeah, I just want to say I think that when I thought about it, after my father's conviction was overturned in 1983, I mean, he could have very well said to the Japanese American community, well, you know, I've been proven that I was right all along. I just want to live my life as an American, just kind of slip back into his everyday routine. And, you know, because we weren't even part of the Japanese American community growing up, I mean, you know, our family, we kind of weren't part of JCL, weren't, you know, part of a Buddhist church or anything where there was a big Japanese American community. But, you know, the amazing thing is that my father, you know, he just took up the cause. The community, you know, kind of put their arms around him, and he put his arms around the community, and then started, you know, with the work of redress. I mean, if I truly believe that if my father's conviction and these others had not been vacated, I don't know if we would have had the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, because they set the precedent for that, and they all did their you know, work to help. To help that make that happen. And I know my parents went to Washington D.C. to lobby. And then my father always felt like, you know, in order for this not to happen again, like this Japanese, like the internment, that you need to, you know, keep educating and speak out. And that's what he did. And then after 9/11, when his Supreme Court case was going to be cited as a reason to round up Arab and Muslim Americans and put them again in American concentration camps, you know, he said no. He spoke out no, you know, along with the JACL. So, you know, what happened was, it was great that the community just really rose up and continues to rise up. And I think that's what our strength is, that we need to pass on to our next generation.
Thank you so much again. Thank you, all of you, for joining us. Thank you, Jay, Holly, Karen, for sharing with us.